Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Hello, everyone. I'm Siri Vaith, Executive Director of the Cystic Fibrosis Research Institute, and I welcome you to this follow-up Q&A with Dr. Rick Moss on COVID-19 and CF. Those of you who were at our conference were very fortunate to see his incredible presentation. We did not have enough time to answer questions, and so we are so grateful to Dr. Moss for returning to answer these questions. As always, I have to note the information presented in this recording should not be used for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and please consult with your medical care team before making any changes. This Q&A is part of our CF Community Voices podcast series, and I do want to thank the sponsors of the series for their support: Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Gilead Sciences, Genentech, Viatris, and Chiesi USA. We are so grateful for their support. As you know, the information about COVID-19 and vaccines is changing rapidly. This recording is being done on Monday, August 16th. So now on to the questions. Dr. Rick Moss has made major contributions to the international field of CF in the areas of research, education, and clinical care. He's a former director of the Stanford CF Center and professor emeritus of pediatric medicine at Stanford, where he continues to conduct clinical research. Lucky for us, he's also a member of CFRI's board. It's been a really challenging year for all of us, and I do want to thank Dr. Moss on behalf of the broader CF community for generously sharing his time repeatedly, continuously, to help us navigate the pandemic. And so, as in previous podcasts, I am this time asking questions that were submitted during our conference. So welcome, Dr. Moss, and thank you for returning.
Thanks for having me back.
So first question, I'd heard that solid organ transplant recipients had about a 20% mortality rate with COVID. All transplants, not just CF and lungs. But you mentioned during your presentation at conference a much lower number, around 5 to 6%. Is this due to vaccines? Do CF lung transplant recipients have lower mortality rates than other transplant recipients?
So I went back and looked at the published literature on this, and there's a variety of different numbers that have been put out for CF transplant. And those numbers have ranged in terms of mortality from a little under 6%. The highest figure was 13%. So the one question is, you know, what's the best comparator? There is a study from France that looked at all the lung transplant recipients in the roughly the first half of 2020 in the country of France, and their overall death rate in that population, which includes some CF but a lot of non-CF, was 14%. So I think the fairest thing to say is that there's no elevated risk to people with CF who have transplants compared to other transplant recipients. And in terms of overall transplants, I'm sure that lung transplants are among the most vulnerable because they are usually considered much more at risk for rejection and infection than, for example, kidney transplants or even heart transplants. So that's at the high end. And I don't think there's an elevated risk to people with CF above their non-CF colleagues who have had to have lung transplants.
Okay. Doesn't the younger age of CF, of the CF population, confound the overall lower rates of COVID in people with CF? When rates are done by age-specific groups, COVID rates in people with CF are higher, right?
Well, I think there's a couple of things to distinguish here. Are we talking about rates of infection, or are we talking rates of illness? So that's one issue. The other is the age matching. The population studies comparing CF to non-CF have not adjusted for age. So I think the questioner seems to me to be correct in pointing out that the general population is much older than the CF population. So adjusted for age, it may, in fact, that advantage that we see overall may disappear, but it's certainly not going to be higher than the general population, as far as I can tell. And as far as illness goes, the best figures for that are hospitalization rates, and there is information on that published which does show that adjusted for age, people with CF do have higher hospitalization rates than non-CF. That is clearly true. Again, age matching is an important thing because age plays such a huge role in susceptibility, not so much to getting infected, but to getting sick with COVID. So I think keeping that in mind is important, as it is when we talk about vaccines, you know, looking at the figures for infection versus those for illness. Two very different numbers come out of that, especially with Delta. So people should keep that distinction in mind. The vaccines are really protecting against illness rather so much against infection. They do help, but not nearly as much.
Which is why I feel kind of crazy when everybody who's vaccinated feels safe taking their masks off. I feel like I want to wear a placard that says, you can still get COVID. This is not for sure yet. So do you have a question? Do you have any idea why carriers of CF have an increase in worse prognosis?
I'm not sure there's a lot of information about that. I do know that there was a very interesting study from the University of Iowa that was put out last year, beginning of last year, which looked at the biggest study to date on CF carriers, okay? Not CF patients, CF carriers, that showed that carriers do have higher rates than the general population for virtually every CF complication, things like sinusitis, bronchiectasis, ABPA, diabetes, you name it. There's a statistically significant increase. It's still a small risk, but it is increased. I don't know that there's really data about that pertains to COVID specifically for carriers. I haven't seen that, so I can't really comment on that. But technically, if they're more at risk for CF complications, they may be at more risk to develop some illness if they do contract COVID. I think that is possible.
Is there any evidence that COVID has a long-term worsening of other lung complications for people with CF, such as pneumothorax or hemoptysis?
Again, we have a dearth of data now in terms of complications. I know that this information is being collected, you know, through the patient registry. Eventually, that will be sifted through, and we'll probably get some information on that. I have not heard or seen examples of increased risk for certain serious complications like pneumothorax or hemoptysis. That doesn't mean it won't happen, but it just right now we can't say for sure if there is any increase.
Do the biological factors that might affect COVID severity in CF offer any avenues for treatment for the general population?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. At this point, again, I think it's very theoretical. The biological factors that have been put out there are, at this point, unproven. They're sort of speculative, but they're possible. So I know that studies are being done now to look at that. Most of these studies are at the basic science level, for example, taking tissue cultures and looking how CF respiratory cells might compare to non-CF in terms of certain features. So after challenge with that virus. So I don't think we know at this point if there are any protective factors. Technically speaking, it's possible it could cut either way. So just to give one example, we know the virus enters respiratory cells through this receptor called ACE2. And we also, there is some speculation that that may be different in CF, up or down. It's not proven yet. And also that there are certain enzymes in the blood that help the virus get into the cells. These are so-called proteases, and certain proteases can change the conformation of the spike protein to allow it to activate and get into the cell more easily. So in CF, those proteases are elevated compared to healthy people, it's at least in the respiratory tract. But the inhibitors, that is the things that kind of dampen that, are also elevated in CF, and the balance can change depending on the stage of CF. So it's actually quite a complicated issue, and I'm not sure we'll ever really get a very clear picture of whether there are certain biological issues related to CFTR and CF that apply. But I think that those studies are ongoing, and we'll get some information probably within the next 6 to 12 months as this research goes forward.
Can you give more information about how monoclonal antibodies work? How does one access this? Is it only available in research medical centers?
Yeah, I think this is a very important question for the CF community. And it's, I don't think it's maybe not as well appreciated as it should be. There are now several of these products that are available commercially. They're available under the emergency use authorization track from the FDA. At least two different companies that are doing this. The way they work is once you've been exposed, the antibodies provide basic passive protection against the virus in the same way that the vaccines induce the immunity. It's the same antibodies we're talking about. They're producing, these antibodies are made in the test tube, but then given to people passively and provide immediate levels of the antibodies that otherwise would take weeks to build up after infection or vaccination. So it's a kind of quick way to get these antibodies there. And that's how they work. They work at that very early stage of latching onto the virus and preventing it from getting into the cell. So the way they're given now is through an infusion center, or most recently, this is very good news, the FDA has okayed the use of a subcutaneous injection of a cocktail of these antibodies from one company called Regeneron. And there's a website which is called covid.infusioncenter.org. Again, I'll repeat that, covid.infusioncenter, all one word, small letters, .org, where you can go on that website and, you know, put in your zip code or your city, and it will tell you where the nearest place is that offers that. So this is a nice service. I think it's sponsored by Regeneron, which is one of the two companies that are making these antibodies. There was a third set of antibodies from Lilly, which the FDA withdrew the emergency use authorization for because they lost activity against Delta. So, but we still have two preparations that seem to work quite well. And they prevent hospitalization in non-CF people at least 70, maybe 80% of the time, which is a big deal. So if you have CF and if you get exposed and are test positive, within the first few days, you should go and get this antibody treatment if you've not been vaccinated. So those are important things. And maybe even if you have been vaccinated, check with your doctor. But there is national ability. Coverage I can't speak to, but at least they are available. And it's an important tool, very important tool for vulnerable folks like the CF community.
That is so useful, having that website. So thank you for repeating it. Now, at the time of the conference, of course, the third shot, the third vaccine had not been approved, right? So how do I obtain the third shot if I've had a transplant and it is not recommended or approved? Now it is, but can people, altering that question, access a third vaccine just by contacting their physician, or going to any other vaccination site? How does that work?
Well, things are changing rapidly. And just even since the conference, that's been a big change, obviously. So the third shot, which is not really a booster so much as somebody put it as a third primary immunization series, like you would do for childhood immunization, to further increase antibody levels, is now available for people with solid organ transplants. That includes lung and liver, of course. So yes, if anyone's had a transplant, they should seek to get that. The accessibility, I think, is being rolled out very rapidly. For example, at my institution at Stanford, I just got an email this morning saying that they're ramping up their data set lists so that everyone who they can verify is eligible has access to it as soon as today. So it should be available for that group of people. There are other patients that are also vulnerable who I know are interested. And in fact, we know that the government is looking very closely now at whether or not to offer third shots more broadly. But so far, beyond people who have transplants who are taking significant immunosuppressive medication or who have significant immunosuppressive disease, those are the three groups that are really the target of this current authorization. So you may have some pushback if, for example, you're someone with CF and your lung function is 30%, and you're worried, you've had your vaccinations, your two shots, but you don't know if you're still protected or not. You want to get the third shot. It's probably going to involve a discussion with your doctor And I think many physicians will go ahead and try and help you get that shot.
And this wasn't on the list of questions, but that does make me want to ask for people, because antibody testing is not common practice, right, for people with CF. Now, people post-transplant, yes. So for somebody whose lung function is low, who they feel more fragile, is that a person who could possibly push their caregiver to have do the antibody testing?
Absolutely. I think if you're in that situation, again, this is not something that they want to recommend very broadly, clearly, because, you know, as I discussed partly at the conference, but also generally speaking, that test doesn't assure you whether you're protected or not. It has a general applicability. But certainly if you show no evidence of antibodies after two shots and you can present that information, that would be obviously an argument to go ahead and get the third shot. So in that particular situation, I think if you can get the testing done in your area, especially if they are measuring neutralizing antibodies, which not every lab does, this is something much more difficult. But if you can get that information, it could be helpful in arguing to get the third shot. And who knows, by the time this you put this up on the website, you know, maybe the government have already said we're going to roll out the third shots for the general population or people over 60 or what have you. We do know that in other places like the country of Israel, anyone over 60 is now going to get a third shot, at least be offered a third shot. So this could well happen here. There's a big argument going on about, you know, how best to utilize our vaccine supply. We do know we have actual surplus supply in this country, even though in other countries there's a clear need, a crying need for more. So considerations of international relationship also plays a role here. But right now there's a big surplus, so they should be able to do that if they want.
Which you answered another question, because somebody had asked about the World Health Organization's recommendation or hope that countries who have lots of vaccine would forego the third dose and wait on that until they share vaccines with underdeveloped nations. So,
I just checked the other day, and right now they're estimating that about 25% of the world population has gotten at least one dose. And that's nowhere near enough to, as we know in the United States, with 50%, we're not exactly stopping the Delta variant. So imagine what it's like in the rest of the world in countries that have 1, 10, 15% of their population vaccinated. It's basically, you know, there's not been a response yet. So yeah, it's a huge issue for world cooperation. And the way the world is going these days, it doesn't look so good. So we just have to try and take care of our own, I guess.
Yeah, and it is related to that. With variants having time to emerge due to low vaccination rates, are we going to be living with COVID forever?
Yeah, I think the answer is probably almost certainly yes. What most people are sort of forecasting now is a situation quite like influenza, where we have the disease endemically, seasonally, coming back year after year. There's some hope that the coronavirus doesn't mutate as fast as influenza. It's an RNA virus, doesn't mutate as quickly as influenza virus does. But with an unvaccinated majority of the world, it has a lot of room to spread and to evolve. So hopefully the mutants that come after Delta won't be more dangerous, but nobody can assure anyone that that's the case. So we have to keep plugging away. The good news is that the technology these days is such that we should be able to chase dangerous mutants fairly quickly. Now that we know that mRNA vaccines work so well, those can be designed very quickly. And as quickly as you can put them out, you can get them out. If people will accept them, then we should be able to stay ahead of the game.
Somebody asked, recognizing the health disparities and racist practices that have contributed to many people of color having distrust toward the medical system in general and vaccines in particular, how are vaccination rates across racial and ethnic groups now?
Yeah, when I checked on this, a good source for that is the Kaiser Family Foundation, which has been tracking that in their network, a very large network of people. And as you might expect, rates of vaccination are lower in people of color communities, African Americans, Hispanics, than in the Caucasian population. But the good news is that those rates are now converging, that they're sort of catching up. So the outreach to the non-white community is improving, and some of the skepticism is receding. And Delta probably plays a role in that as people see their friends and neighbors and others sick. So hopefully those disparities will gradually vanish. We're not there yet, though. It's still lower in those communities than in the white community.
So much is said about the high viral load of the Delta variant in the sinuses, something 1,000 times from other strains, variants. Is there any strategy to neutralize the virus in the nasal passages?
Yeah, the viral load measurements were in the nose. It's hard to get into the sinuses unless you've had surgeries. And then, CF people know about the surgery, but for most people, you really have to take that sample from the nose. So these are nasal samples. And it's true, it supports the idea that the reason the Delta is spreading so quickly and completely is that it has such a marked increase in its ability to infect the nasal passages. As bad as chickenpox and 2 to 3 times worse than the previous coronaviruses that caused the SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19. So the question about are there strategies to try and deal with that is that yes, there's a lot of work being done in that regard. There are two broad areas. One is to develop a vaccine that can be given directly into the nose. Nasal spray, we have this for the flu. The flu mist, as some folks listening probably know, is given for the flu as an alternative to getting a shot. That will certainly help with people that are needle phobic. There's some evidence that it might be more effective because that's where the immunity needs to be, in the lining of the airways, not so much in the deep tissues of the body, at least not initially. So it has some sense to it. It's been harder to develop those, but there are companies working on it, and I expect we probably eventually will see some nasal vaccines for COVID, but we're not close. I don't know of any phase 3 studies at this point, so it's not close to happening, but in the next year or two, it may be. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on that. The other way that one can think about it is to develop chemical approaches that can block the entry of the virus into the nasal passages, and there's lots of different research in that regard. So both vaccine approaches and more chemical-based approaches are certainly being tested. And there are a lot of people with a background in immunology who argue that this ultimately could be a better approach in the long run. It just takes longer to develop, and we'll see how things work out in that regard.
The big question, how do we convince vaccinated people to maintain protections? Seems so many people are not wearing masks because they're vaccinated as if they are fully protected. Knowing that people can be symptomless and still spreading the virus, we know so much. How do we convince people?
It's interesting. I think you have to give folks credit. The polling data seems to indicate that a lot of people are continuing to wear, they're back with masking without mandates. Many people are still relying on that and distancing. So I don't think it's hopeless. I think the issue is how complete does that need to be to really break up the transmission cycle? That's the real question. And there's a lot of doubt that unless you get up of 80 or 90%, you'll be able to do that effectively. So if we have states where there's 30, 40% vaccination rates, they're still basically unprotected. And you obviously can't rely on knowing if that person over there has been vaccinated and that person over there has not been vaccinated. And you also know that that person over there that's been vaccinated can still be infected even though they're not sick and can still spread the virus to someone who is more vulnerable. So how do we do it? It's just a question of persisting education and outreach and good messaging, good communication. There's been, I think, some merited criticism of the CDC for their messaging capabilities in the last year to two. So they've had some missteps and they have to own that and just keep working at it. But I think ultimately that's all you can do short of mandates. Now, will we need to have mandates? More and more situations indicate that we may have to rely on mandates to do that. So we see businesses, we see certain municipalities, school districts, some larger political entities going for mandates. And I think that's really based on how much disease there is and how much transmission there is within a particular community. So I think it's a mix of education and, if necessary, mandates. People don't like mandates, but you know, we live with all kinds of mandates and a lot of other things. And this whole issue is just been puzzling to me and a lot of other people as to why this has suddenly become such an outrage when seatbelts, no smoking areas, you know, you go down the whole list, speed limits. You know, we accept everything like that in our society for the greater good. And yet now here we are with these huge raging arguments about wearing a mask. There's something maybe in the human psychology about your face that changes things. It would take a long time to really understand.
Well, I hope we don't drop it in the sense of studying it and figuring that out, because the next wave that comes through, hopefully we'll have better strategies for convincing people to do so. So here's the big question for all those parents out there. What about kids? Should I send my child with CF, who's too young to be vaccinated, to in-person school in the fall, meaning like today?
Yeah, that I think is a very personal and local issue and decision. In general, in public schools, you know, the power lies with the school district. Although now we're learning that now the governors claim power over certain school districts, or mayors may claim power over certain school districts. So you have to be aware of the lay of the land where you live. And beyond whether or not mandates are being applied, what the policy of the school district is, you need to know what that is and have a discussion with the teacher or the people who are the administrative staff for that particular school. There's also private schools, parochial schools. I mean, it's not just public schools we're talking about. And the level of the age of the patient, the age of the person, of the kid. There is some difference between preschool and school age and, you know, adolescence. So all those things have to be factored in. I think it's important, from my thinking, the really important thing is to know whether or not masking is going to be employed in the classroom, whether or not there's good enough ventilation in that classroom, and whether the teachers and staff are going to be vaccinated. Those are three very important questions to answer about that. The other sort of unknown at this point is when will vaccines for children be authorized? My understanding is that may come as early as next month, within the next 4 weeks or so. And will probably involve just the 5 to 11 year age group initially. So if that does come, then I think a lot of kids in that age group are going to be vaccinated pretty quickly. And that will also have an effect on the overall attitude of how comfortable parents feel about sending their kids to school.
And the last question, can you tell us again the name of the vaccine website that you said we could all trust? There was a...
Websites, yes. The one that I mentioned in my talk, which I think is really wonderful, is called vaccineconfidence.org, all one word, vaccineconfidence, all lowercase, .org. It's run out of London, out of the Institute for Tropical Medicine there. And the reason I like it so much is that it really talks about education and outreach. It grapples with the whole subject of vaccine hesitancy and vaccine denialists and refusals and conspiracies, all those things, in a very calm and concerted way. There's a lot of information, a ton of different resources available. And it's for really someone who's really interested in exploring maybe what they could do to help, you know, in a positive way, rather than just yelling at people. Like I saw the Arnold Schwarzenegger interview, you know, don't be a schmuck, put on this mask up, right? So that's one approach, but it doesn't work for a lot of people. So this is a really an alternative that's really based on solid fact, reliable information, and ways to improve outreach, to have the right conversations with folks that are not vaccinated. The other, I'd mention one other thing, as the CDC really has a really nice set of pages on vaccines that are very comprehensive. When you go to the CDC and COVID vaccine webpage, it has an index of many different aspects that also is very, very helpful. So it really depends on what kind of information you'd like and what you'd like to do with it. But this is an issue that is going to be with us for a long time. This disease is going to be with us in new forms for a long time. We know that now, by the way we've seen variants evolve. We know that there are other viruses out there, other pathogens out there that are going to be causing pandemics in the future. The world is just, there's too many people, we're spread out too close to nature. You know, it's just the nature of modernity that this is a permanent issue for humanity now. So we've got to learn how to deal with it intelligently and successfully. And the results so far have been mixed. We've had some big successes, mostly on the technology side, and we've had some huge failures, mostly on the political social side. So this is a big project for all of us, probably for the rest of our lives.
Truly, that is a drop the mic statement. And with that, I thank you so much for returning to do this follow-up podcast from all the questions from the conference. For those of you who have not seen the conference presentation that Dr. Moss shared, we will have it on our YouTube channel. You really should go back. Dr. Moss has truly been the voice of reason for all of us in the CF community as we navigate this incredibly challenging time. Dr. Moss, thank you.
Thank you again, and stay safe.